Hello, welcome to The Profit Margin with me, Naomi McMullen, and Jamie DeLargy. This week, it's all about Brexit. What will the outcomes and outworkings of it really mean for business here?
You're listening to The Profit Margin with First Trust Bank.
More than 3 months on from the EU referendum vote, you would imagine the implications of Brexit would be a good bit clearer. That seems not to be the case. The Chancellor did issue a statement about a month ago which reassured farmers that come what may, they would get EU subsidies until 2020. Universities and research bodies were also given similar guarantees about funding, but others have been left in the dark over access to EU structural funds, leading to fears that a deep well of money may be drying up. Well, when she came into the Profit Margin, the head of the European Commission office here, Colette Fitzgerald, tried to shed as much light as she could on a very uncertain situation when she spoke with Jamie.
Colette, since the Brexit vote in June, there's been an enormous amount of speculation about the eventual relationship between the UK, including Northern Ireland, and the EU. But is there, in that space of time, developed any certainty surrounding this issue?
Quite the opposite, Jamie. In fact, the uncertainty has deepened since the result of the vote in June. I think it's important to make clear that Brexit actually hasn't happened yet. The vote has happened, but for Brexit to happen, that requires the UK government to invoke Article 50. I think by now most people are familiar with that. That's the legal position. And until Article 50 is invoked, there can be no negotiations. So we can't say with any certainty what will happen after the formal exit of the UK from the European Union. But in the meantime, there is, as you say, a lot of speculation. People are coming out with statements about what they would like to see happen. But of course, in this period of uncertainty, we cannot guarantee any of those outcomes.
In August, the Chancellor did issue a statement which provided some comfort for farmers and others by, if you like, guaranteeing funding, certain funding until 2020. That, of course, raised a question mark in the minds of some others who might have been seeking particularly cash from structural funds. Now, what is the situation with regard to all that?
Well, it's very clear, Jamie. The situation from the European Union's perspective is nothing has changed. The UK remains a full member of the European Union. And as such, the structural fund programmes with the EU money that is available to Northern Ireland are still on the table. These are programmes that were available up until the 31st of December 2020 for projects to be approved. The EU money is still there. It's still on the table. For questions on the national co-financing, which is required to draw down that EU money, I'm afraid you have to ask the Chancellor.
Well, I suppose what you seem to be saying is that these funds, the drawdown from them does depend on match funding from the national government. And is that the question mark that you're talking about? Is there no certainty or no difficulty, if you like, in the EU continuing to provide those funds until 2020 should the UK continue to be a member of the EU until that point?
Absolutely. The EU money is still on the table as foreseen. And until the UK leaves, that money is still available. And it is only when Article 50 is triggered that questions like this, which are raising uncertainties, can be answered. Or at least we will know what the UK wants in terms of the timing of leaving and what the position will be concerning its financial contributions. But what I can say with certainty, and I can only speak for the EU money, is that it's still available and it's still there for projects to apply for. But of course, there must be national co-financing to go with it.
Colette, thanks very much.
Well, when Theresa May became Prime Minister, we looked to her for guidance on Europe. We tried to make sense of her famous mantra, Brexit means Brexit, before giving up in defeat. But if the slogan means anything at all, it is that there's no turning back, no new vote. In a few years' time, the UK will be out of the EU. When that happens, the money that used to go to Brussels will be spent at home. Economist Professor Neil Gibson, director of the Ulster University Economic Policy Centre, says we shouldn't automatically use this windfall to replicate the EU funding of the past. Here's his interview with Jamie.
I think there's two things to think about. The first one is being very honest and looking back at what we've spent and try to learn something from that. Some things have been working, some have not. So we've spent money in all sorts of ways around peace projects, around the different cap monies that we've spent in the agriculture sector. We really need to say, has that worked precisely for Northern Ireland? Or if we could do it differently, would we do it? So lessons from the past is one. And the second thing is, if we really look at Northern Ireland's economic future, it needs to be a question of investing in the productive capacity, the things that will allow the economy to grow faster in future. It can't be, if you like, a subsidy culture where what we're trying to do is keep things as they are for as long as we can afford to do so. So really focusing heavily on what would be the right spending to incentivise the sort of growth that we aspire to. And to be honest, that doesn't mean repeating exactly what was done in the past.
Clearly, we will have a debate and all stakeholders will contribute to that. And to some extent, we can't preempt the outcome of those discussions. But what would your pitch be? What would you say to a gathering that was looking at these issues?
The most important thing is to focus on what you want to achieve. What does success look like? It's far too easy to think about what have I got money for in the past and how do I protect that money? That would be a very retrograde way to look at this and actually miss the opportunity that we might be presented with. What exactly are we trying to do to incentivize a more efficient and effective farming industry, for example, or in terms of those border communities that have benefited so richly from much of the peace money? What do we want to put in place that makes them sustainable going forward? So in a way, the first piece of advice is to step away from what the spending looks like today and ask the question, what are we aiming at? And if we had a pot of money, which we may well have, what would I want to spend on that? So thinking about things like the skills policy, the infrastructure, the big questions that you might have in an area, rather than, as we find, and to be quite frank, if we look around many of our funding organisations, they have quite rightly focused on what's the application form say, what do I need to do to get this money, so-called referred to as ambulance chasing almost, just look for the funding scheme and then make sure that we can find some way of telling a story that fits that. That really isn't that effective way to go about it. So actually, in one way, the biggest challenge facing Northern Ireland is almost to cleanse your mind of that history and say, what are we trying to achieve? And that might be different, for example, for a Newry to a Derry to a Belfast. They'll have different questions that they would want to spend their money on. But going into this by saying whatever we got, we'd like to keep it, do exactly the same thing, would be a real missed opportunity.
There are specific needs because we are will be the only part of the UK that will have a land border with an EU state, an EU member state. So what specifically would you urge our negotiators who will be involved in these national negotiations to ask on our behalf?
I think that's probably the most critical thing. In the early conversations I've had with firms to date, it's interesting how most of them have focused on access to labour as their biggest issue, rather than, say, tariffs or tariff rates. But when we talk to local people, the uncertainty about what does the border look like, the image that people have of having to be stopped and go through a checkpoint, we need to very quickly think about what a modern border looks like, possibility of technology helping us here in terms of how we may read number plates and be able to, for example, think of a very modern way of declaring customs and imports and exports. A lot of people have talked about, well, we can't really have an open border because it'll allow people into the UK. But of course, you can't work without a national insurance number, so it's not really that as big a problem as it sounds. But that is a very uniquely, the physical border is a very uniquely Northern Ireland issue. And that's the one where I would want, for example, the negotiators to focus very heavily now on what they want that to look like, talk to our counterparts in Ireland and think about what's a workable, modern, technologically low on burden, keep the kind of feeling of openness and freedom that we've already developed, because that's not going to be a prime issue for the UK negotiators who are mostly worried about the City of London and the financial implications there. So we can park a lot of the big issues and say, what does a modern border look like? That would be one of the skills issues will be germane to Northern Ireland, but so they will to other parts. I think the border one is the one that I would really be incentive or encouraging our negotiators to focus very heavily on. And in that, they should be talking now to people who, for example, commute across the border or people who regularly trade across the border and asking, how's this going to impact them? What different solutions are they? I've yet to see mooted possible ways that this would work. I think that's what we want to see over the next few months because it's the unique Northern Ireland.
And talking of travel across borders, what sort of protection and entitlement does an Irish passport offer? Many of those who fear the consequences of Brexit are treating it as a get out of jail card. But is that useful? Jamie spoke to Paul Gillen of Lawyers Pinsent Mason.
Paul, post-Brexit, what protection, what advantage is afforded to a Northern Ireland resident who holds an Irish passport in terms of accessing work opportunities in EU countries, including, of course, the Irish Republic?
Well, as a holder of an Irish passport, you're an Irish citizen, but you're also deemed to be an EU national. And yes, there's rights to access the employment market and also access to other benefits, but also free travel. It does mean that if you want, you can go and live in another EU country to look for work or also to be employed or to study.
Is that a definitive advantage that that person would have over someone from Northern Ireland who doesn't have an Irish passport?
Well, of course, you wouldn't have to jump through any of the hoops, such as immigration or any other restrictions that would be put on you by EU countries, and therefore it would be an advantage because employers would see that as an advantage to you as an applicant, as a member of the workforce, because you would be able to go and work throughout Europe.
It's clear there are some definite advantages from holding that Irish passport, but does it put them in exactly the same footing as a citizen of an EU member state, let's say someone from the south of Ireland?
Well, essentially it does, because a lot of the rights stem from holding the passport. Now, there are others, such as the reciprocal right to benefits, that you would have to go through a further stage. So, for example, if we look at the European health card, if you hold an Irish passport, or indeed now if you hold a UK passport, because of the residency that you have in either one of those countries, you have access to free or cheaper medical cover throughout Europe. However, if post-Brexit there are restrictions put on UK residents, then certainly it would be an advantage to have an Irish passport. But you would also then have to take it a stage further. We may have to apply for a social security number or a health card in the Republic of Ireland. So it's not simply based on the Irish passport, but you may need to show residency as well.
Well, this is all upside, but let's look at a possible downside, which I don't think many people would necessarily expect to be the case. And that is, what about the status of a Northern Ireland person who holds an Irish passport but doesn't hold a UK one? Could they be at a disadvantage post-Brexit because they would be living in a state which is no longer a member of the EU?
Well, this is one I don't think has been thought through just yet, because there's a whole political row to be had there. Well, certainly an interesting aspect for Northern Ireland to consider. So if we look at the theoretical nature of someone who holds an Irish passport but lives in Northern Ireland, a jurisdiction of the UK, then if the EU and if the UK don't come to some agreement in relation to EU nationals remaining or to have access to employment within the UK, then theoretically there could be a position where those who live in Northern Ireland but hold an Irish passport but not a UK passport could be subject to those restrictions. Now, politically, I'm not sure whether anyone would have an appetite to push that through, but certainly, theoretically, yes, there could be a disadvantage.
OK, let's move on to a related issue. If you were a holder of an Irish passport and a resident in Northern Ireland and you owned a Northern Ireland-based company, would you be able to source grants and other support that is now commonly available to people in Northern Ireland? I'm talking, of course, in a post-Brexit situation.
Well, this is one of these who knows questions, because it really comes down to the negotiation in relation to business. Now, this one, if you look at it from a point of view that it's an individual holding an Irish passport, then no, it's unlikely you'd be able to access grants, because the grants would attach to that business. And the issue there is that the business would be located in an area of the UK, and therefore it may be outside the jurisdiction to claim those grants. The issue that goes with that is that if you're an Irish passport holder and you run a business, then it might give you more flexibility to up sticks and take your business to the Republic of Ireland, where you might be able to access those grants.
Yes, and lastly, and it's sort of midway between the issues of the corporate rights and the individual rights, but let's say you wanted to engage in some research opportunities, not a job, but research opportunities in the EU. What do you think would be the position of an Irish passport holder who is resident in Northern Ireland?
Well, again, as an Irish passport holder, you would be an EU national, and therefore you would be free to go throughout Europe for work and for study, and that would include research proposals as well. Paul, thanks very much.
Hopefully that will have shed some light on the subject for you.
You're listening to The Profit Margin with First Trust Bank.
Now with a look at what's coming up in the week ahead, here's Neil Parker from First Trust Bank.
Coming up, we'll have the euro interest rate decision from the ECB. No surprises expected here, with the ECB retaining an easing bias. European interest rates are likely to remain negative until at least 2020. The ECB has faced some criticism recently for wiping out savers' nest eggs and fueling housing bubbles. In the US, we'll be keeping an eye on the non-farm payrolls, a key monthly employment report. We'd expect a strong tone to this report to help reinforce another interest rate hike by the FOMC. This will most likely happen in December. And from the UK, we'll get an estimate for Q3 GDP. This will see the start of the post-Brexit vote key indicators on the impact for the UK economy. I'd expect a dip driven by fairly flat investment and employment over the last quarter. All indicators are economic growth in the UK may stumble in 2017.
Regular listeners will know it's getting to that time of the show. Pitching this week is a Belfast startup that's received funding from one of the former dragons on Dragon's Den. Hayward Hawk is a technology recruitment firm. Here's Anthony Stewart from the company.
Hi there, I'm Anthony Stewart and I'm from Hayward Hawk. We are a technology recruitment company. We specialise only in technology recruitment, from anything from first line support right up to CTO and anything in between. We've some really interesting projects. We've secured some very interesting backers. One who you might know from the TV show on the BBC called Dragon's Den, and that's James Caan. So James, obviously famous for setting up one of the biggest recruitment companies in the world, which is Alexander Mann Solutions, has come on board. He liked us, he liked what we had to bring to the table, something new, something fresh to the Northern Irish / Irish market, and he'd given us financial backing as well as his mentorship and sort of leadership as we're going through our journey. What we're really looking for is long-term partnerships, relationships with clients that we'll have, not just for the short term, not just for the first months to get us started, but ones we'll have sort of years down the line, and we can sort of help them and they can help us also to grow in turn. If you want to find out a bit more about us, you can find us on the usual channels at LinkedIn, our website www.haywardhawk.com, and as well as that, we're trialling some social media platforms, likes of Instagram and Twitter, so you can also follow our journey on there.
That's it for this week. Remember, you can find us on Facebook at The Profit Margin, or on Twitter at The Profit Margin, or email me, naomi@theprofitmargin.co.uk. Do get in touch if you've any thoughts, insights or opinions, or if your business is doing something interesting.
You're listening to The Profit Margin with First Trust Bank.